please be turning to Hosea, the first chapter. We're going to read that in just a minute. And while you're doing that, I'll tell you how appreciative I am that you've come out to be with us today and to spend some time talking about the subject of love from the prophets. The reason we're going to the prophets to talk about love is because that was the interpretive key that Christ gave in Matthew 22 to understanding the prophets. Love God, love your neighbor. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets. And so we're going to be looking into Hosea today to try to see some things about this thing we call love and some of the qualities of it. But let's read beginning in Hosea chapter 1, verse 1. The word of the Lord that came unto Hosea the son of Beeri in the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah, and in the days of Jeroboam the son of Joash, king of Israel. The beginning of the word of the Lord by Hosea. And the Lord said to Hosea, Go take unto thee a wife of whoredoms and children of whoredoms, for the land hath committed great whoredom, departing from the Lord. So he went and took Gomer, the daughter of Diblaim, which conceived and bare him a son. And the Lord said unto him, Call his name Jezreel, for yet a little while, and I will avenge the blood of Jezreel upon the house of Jehu, and will cause to cease the kingdom of the house of Israel. And it shall come to pass at that day that I will break the bow of Israel in the valley of Jezreel. And she conceived again and bare a daughter. And God said unto him, Call her name Lo-Ruhamah, for I will no more have mercy upon the house of Israel, but I will utterly take them away. But I will have mercy upon the house of Judah, and will save them by the Lord their God, and will not save them by bow, nor by sword, nor by battle, by horses, nor by horsemen. Now when she had weaned Lo-Ruhamah, she conceived and bare a son. Then said God, Call his name Lo-Ami, for ye are not my people, and I will not be your God. Yet the number of the children of Israel shall be as the sand of the sea, which cannot be measured nor numbered. And it shall come to pass that in the place where it was said unto them, Ye are not my people, there it shall be said unto them, Ye are the sons of the living God. Then shall the children of Judah and the children of Israel be gathered together, and appoint themselves one head, and they shall come up out of the land, for great shall be the day of Jezreel. There's a famous story, maybe apocryphal, that comes from Art Linkletter's House Party. I grew up watching that show every afternoon. And he'd have those kids on stage, and he had the skit, the part, Kids Say the Darndest Things. And one day, they had given paper to the children. The children were drawing a picture, and he walked up to one little boy and said, What are you drawing? And the boy said, Well, I'm drawing a picture of God. And Art Linkletter said, But nobody knows what God looks like. And the little boy said, They will when I'm finished. And I wonder what kind of a picture of God we'd draw if we were given some paper and said to draw our conception of God. We might draw a being of power, a being of great authority. I doubt that any of us would draw a picture of God such as is drawn in the book of Hosea. How many people would draw a picture of God with a broken heart? How many would draw a picture of God as a jilted husband and with all of the emotions that go along with having the one you love walk out on you? That's the picture of God that comes from the book of Hosea. You know, sometimes when it comes to the commandments of Christ, and especially the commands to love, we're like the guy driving through the country and he came upon this barn on which had been painted a number of bullseyes, and right through the middle of each bullseye was a bullet hole. And he had never seen shooting like that, so he stopped and walked up to the farmhouse and knocked on the door, and the farmer came to the door. And the guy said, I just had to stop. I've never seen anybody shoot like that. And the farmer started to laugh, and he said, Oh, I shoot first, and then I draw the bullseye around the bullet hole. That's the way we are a lot of times. We do whatever we feel like doing. We give to God whatever we feel like giving. And then we draw the bullseye around and convince ourselves we've hit the target. I don't think there is any commandment, any requirement in the Bible that is more demanding, that is tougher or harder than the command to love. And to understand What Love Entails from the Prophet Hosea is to gain some insight into why it is such a difficult thing to do. And the prophets help us understand this. You know, you didn't go to seminary and enroll in Prophet 101 to become a prophet. You were chosen by God. Sometimes you were chosen by God against your will. But when God's call came, it's like Amos said, if you've heard the lion roar, you can't ignore that. And there were times when the prophets were told to do things that they didn't like. In fact, Jeremiah, at one point, got so fed up with the work God was giving him to do, he said, I'm quitting, I want out of here, I'm going to go to the middle of nowhere and open up a Motel 6 and run it. That's what I want to do. But then God would call them back to duty, and they would respond. And often God used PowerPoint illustrations with the prophets. He would have them engage in very dramatic actions, often very absurd, ridiculous kinds of things, to make a point, to draw attention to something. He had Jeremiah in chapter 27 walk around with a yoke on. And that's kind of a strange sight, to see a grown man with a yoke on his neck and shoulders all the time. But God said, when people ask you why you're doing this, you tell them that this is meant to represent the bondage that is coming to Edom and Moab and Ammon and Judah when I send the Babylonians in. God said, Ezekiel, I'm going to kill the one you love more than anyone else. And when I do that, I don't want you to mourn. I don't want you to cry. There's not to be any funeral. I want you to get up and go out and preach. And Ezekiel said, that evening, the Lord took my wife. And the next day I got up and went out and preached. And what God was saying to His people is that because of your sins, I'm going to have to deal severely with you, and it's gotten to the point where I don't even really care anymore. I'm not going to mourn over you. But one of the most dramatic PowerPoints from the prophets is in the passage that we just read. When God says, Hosea, I want you to go out and marry a whore. And that's what Hosea does. And in a minute we'll see why God had Hosea do that. Amos tells us that God must do what He's going to do. If that means He's got to judge His people, He will do it. But Hosea tells us, even when God has to judge His people, He does it with a broken heart. You know, the prodigal came to his father and he said, I want my inheritance. And the father gave him the inheritance and then stood aside while that boy walked out. But you know, you've got to know that that father's heart was breaking as he watched his son leave. Have you ever had your heart broken? Have you ever been in a relationship? Marriage, parent, child, friends, where your heart's been broken? I don't think there's any pain worse than that. There are people, however, who have this idea of God that He never hurts. That because of the deity He is, He never knows pain. He's above all of that. They think that God lives in some sort of nirvana. The word that's used in the Beatitudes, blessed are the poor in spirit, blessed are they that mourn. That was the word the Greeks used to describe the happiness of the gods. Now that was a Greek idea. The fact of the matter is, I don't know anyone who hurts any worse than God. You know, it's a fact that the higher you go on the scale of life, the lower the threshold of pain. It takes a whole lot more to hurt a crab than it does to hurt an elephant. Elephants have more highly developed nervous systems. I've read that a crab can enjoy itself eating a second crab while it in turn is being eaten by a third crab. It takes a lot to hurt a crab, apparently. Now, if we know how much we finite beings hurt when our heart's been broken, Can we even imagine the hurt of the infinite? And that's the picture that Hosea draws for us. Now, let me give you some background to the prophet Hosea. We're talking about the 8th century. Some good kings are ruling down in the south, but Hosea was a prophet to the north during the time of Jeroboam II. Jeroboam II brought in an era of 30 prosperous years. During this time, Israel had the upper hand over her enemies. A generation grew up that had not known defeat. In fact, this generation, some of them, had not even known war. National security and prosperity had not been that great in Israel since the days of Solomon. But it became a very decadent time, and Amos especially describes not only the economic picture, but the opulence and the decadence that came with it. People idled away their days lying on designer furniture, sipping wine, dressed to the hilt, listening to music. And they were religious, but when they went to church, the God they thanked for the prosperity they enjoyed was not Jehovah. It was Baal. And in their lives, they had become secular, worldly, immoral. And the reason God tells Hosea to marry a whore is because, right there in verse 2, He's saying, Israel, that's what I got when I got you. I mean, Hosea may have been the last male virgin in Israel. Amos tells us that during this time, fathers and sons would have relations with the same woman. And Hosea is told to go and do what no self-respecting prophet would ever do, because God is intending in the microcosm of Hosea's marriage to teach us something about His relationship with His people. And so in the first three chapters, we have this narrative, this story of a marriage, the marriage of Hosea and Gomer. He goes out and he finds a woman. He probably didn't have to look very far to find a woman who partook of the spirit of the age in her immorality and in her attitude toward life. And he marries her, and they begin having children. There are three children mentioned in the first chapter. The first is named in verse 3. A boy who is given the name of Jezreel. That would be like calling a son Alamo. Jezreel was a valley that stretched from Mount Carmel to Tabor. The great battles of Israelite history were fought in that valley. Great battles of the Crusades were fought there. The Second Crusade, the Crusaders suffered a terrible defeat at the hands of Salah al-Din, just outside the horns of Hattin, there on the eastern end of the Jezreel Valley. This is where Megiddo was. This is where Armageddon was. And God said, you call this boy Jezreel. The word Jezreel means to sow, to scatter. And the word appears several times there in the first chapter. It's a word that speaks not only of judgment. You're going to be scattered. Your group is going to be blown apart. But it's a word that also speaks of hope. It's a word that speaks of a farmer scattering and sowing the seed and having a harvest as a result. And God's saying, I'm going to judge you, but even in the judging there is hope. Look at verse 15 of chapter 2, where God says, I'm going to give you the valley of Achor. The word Achor means trouble. I'm going to give you trouble for a door of hope. God's chastening His people. Chastening is something you do to a son. Chastening is not what a judge does to a criminal. Chastening, although it may be similar to what a judge does, is what a father does to a son. And God's going to scatter His people because in that scattering, in that judging, was to be found their hope, to bring them to their senses. And so you name this boy Jezreel because scattering's coming. But then look at verse 6. A second child's born. This child is a daughter. And notice, verse 6 says, she conceived again and bare a daughter. Compare that with verse 3, where the text says, she conceived and bare him a son. I have no doubt that the first boy was Hosea's. I'm not so sure the second child was. It may be that Gomer was already starting to run around on her husband. And this daughter was given a name every bit as strange as the boy was given. You call her Lo-Ruhamah, for I will no more have mercy upon the house of Israel. I'm going to come back to that in a minute. But God's talking about the attitude that He's going into this judgment with. I'm not going to have mercy on you anymore. And then a third child was born, a second son, verse 9. And again, it simply says that she conceived and bare a son, called his name Lo-Ami, which means not my people. To the people of God, I'm not going to have any more mercy on you. And you're not going to be my people. Judgment is coming. There's going to be a scattering, but in that scattering is hope. Remember the parable of the tares? What was scattered in the earth were the children of the kingdom. It's not the gospel that's being scattered in the parable of the tares. It's believers who are being scattered. And in the scattering of God's people, even though they were scattered due to judgment, there would be hope for the world. There would be hope for Gentile nations and for others. But God is having to harden Himself emotionally for this to happen. Now, at some point, Gomer left. And chapter 2 brings out the significance of God telling Hosea to marry a whore. She wasn't a prostitute with a heart of gold. She was one who had betrayed the love this man had for her, who had taken his gifts and used them on her lovers, unfaithful, disloyal. And in chapter 2, God talks about the parallel. Look at verse 2. Plead with your mother, plead, for she is not my wife, neither am I her husband. Let her therefore put away her whoredoms out of her sight and her adulteries from between her breasts. Verse 5. For their mother hath played the harlot. She hath conceived them. She that conceived them hath done shamefully, for she said, I will go after my lovers that give me my bread, my water, my wool, my flax, mine oil, my drink. Baal is the one who's given me all of this. Baal's the one who's made me prosperous. I'm going to go and have an affair with Baal. And to carry out the analogy, there was a day when Hosea came home, and he noticed something was different. There wasn't the normal, usual sounds of a wife preparing dinner in the kitchen or cleaning up. The house was silent. And I'm sure he found a note. When women leave, they always leave a note. Maybe it said something like this, Gomer, or Hosea, I'm gone. I'm not happy. Maybe she said, you're too involved with your work. And life is too short for me to be unhappy. So I'm going to grab for all the gusto I can get. Sincerely, but no longer yours, Gomer. And that had to break that man's heart. I have no doubt that what Hosea loved Gomer with all of his heart. And now she's walked out, and she's not bettered herself at all. Look at chapter 3. Let's read, starting with verse 1. Then said the Lord unto me, Go yet, love a woman beloved of her friend, yet an adulteress according to the love of the Lord toward the children of Israel, who look to other gods and love flagons of wine. So I bought her to me for 15 pieces of silver, and for a homer of barley, and a half homer of barley. You know, when Israel left God, and let me show you what they were doing that constituted their leaving Him. Look at chapter 4, verse 2. Here's what they were doing. By swearing and lying and killing and stealing and committing adultery, they break out and blood touches blood. 5 of the 10 commandments are mentioned there in that one verse. Israel ignoring, violating every one of them. And God's heart was broken. And as a broken-hearted husband, He had all of the emotions that people whose hearts have been broken go through. Oh, He had anguish. We read that in chapter 1, verse 6, verse 9 and 10. He was anguished. He was angry. He tells Israel in chapter 2, listen, your crops are going to fail. You think Baal's been bringing you all of these bumper crops. Your crops are going to fail. You're not going to get away with it. I'm going to wipe the smile off your face. But greater than his anguish and greater than his anger, look at verse 14 of chapter 2. Therefore, behold, I will allure her. Now that's the language of love. Love doesn't use words like manipulation. Love doesn't use words like control. Love doesn't use words like force. Love always seeks a loving response. That's the nature of love. But it does so, real love does so, by loving the one from whom you seek love. I will allure her. I will entice her. How? With more love. By showing even more love. I'll do what I have to do. I'll do it with a broken heart. But I will allure her. And that's what God has Hosea do. Now, how hard was that? How humiliating was that? You see, when he went to find his wife, when he finally found her, she was in the gutter. She apparently had gotten so low in her adultery that she either sold herself or pimped herself to where Hosea had to take all the money he had, and that wasn't enough, so he had to liquidate some possessions, sell some grain, to come up with enough money to buy this faithless woman back. That's what love does. I don't see myself as Hosea in this, I see myself as Gomer. I see myself as the one who is jilted the Lord, and who has cheapened myself, and who has on occasion gone after the gods of this world. And yet God, despite the anguish I brought, despite the anger He's had, continues to allure me, to call me back, and is willing to pay whatever price it takes to get me back. I want to show you something. There in chapter 1 again, that second child, Lo Ruhamah, for I will have no more mercy upon the house of Israel. You know what's one of the greatest passages in the book of Hosea that is used in the Gospels? Turn to Hosea chapter 6 and look at verse 6. For I desire mercy and not sacrifice. In chapter 1, no more mercy. But even in chapter 1, God goes back on that. He says there in verse 10, after just saying, you're not my children anymore, you're not my people anymore, right after he says that, you'll be my people again. God just cannot keep his anger forever. He just can't stay angry with us. And that's not because of us, that's because of him. And this great statement, I desire mercy and not sacrifice. Turn to the Gospel of Matthew chapter 9. Christ uses this passage twice. And I want to show you how great it is in the places where Christ uses it. Matthew chapter 9, starting with verse 10. And it came to pass as Jesus sat at meat in the house, behold, many publicans and sinners came and sat down with him and his disciples. And when the Pharisees saw it, they said unto his disciples, why eateth your master with publicans and sinners? But when Jesus heard that, he said unto them, they that behold need not a physician, but they that are sick. But go ye and learn what that meaneth. I will have mercy and not sacrifice, for I am not come to call the righteous, but sinners to repentance. E. Stanley Jones said, this is possibly the greatest thing Jesus ever said. You know, sometimes theologians like to diminish Christianity by pointing out the parallels between things Jesus said and things Confucius said or Mohammed said, to show that in other religions there are similar principles to Christianity. I'll tell you what, there's one thing that Jesus said that you're not going to find in any other religion, and I just read it. In every man-made religion, sinners are redeemed by improving themselves, by climbing up the ladder. They're at the bottom of the ladder, God's up at the top, and by a process of self-improvement and purification, somehow or other, they get high enough to where God finally takes notice of them. Christianity alone says God left the top of the ladder and came down to the very bottom. Because that's where I was. And then he's taken me back to the top. It wasn't Gomer who found Hosea. It was Hosea who went and found Gomer. And what a contrast between God's view of dealing with sinners and say, the Pharisees' view of dealing with sinners. The Pharisees thought that because there can be no fellowship between light and darkness, that the way you deal with a sinner is by isolating them, ostracizing them. And that means don't show any warmth to them. Don't show any kindness. If you happen to bump into them at the line at the grocery store, don't be friendly, because they might misconstrue that. If you smile at them, they might think that you're saying they're okay in whatever they're doing. And here's Jesus sitting at a meal, a party if you will, a reception is what it was actually, with those the Pharisees and scribes regarded as sinners, publicans and sinners. And they're indignant. And they ask the disciples, what in the world is your master doing? And in Christ's response, he teaches four important things. He teaches, number one, that it's possible to associate with sinners without being contaminated by their sin, without endorsing them in their sin. I mean, folks, how are we ever going to convert sinners unless we get close to some sinners? If you don't know your next door neighbor well enough to invite them over for coffee, probably you're not going to convert them. Jesus associated with sinners because, number two, he was more concerned about his responsibility than his reputation. The Pharisees said, "Birds of a feather flock together. You can tell a man by the company he keeps." That isn't the way Jesus saw it. Thirdly, he taught us that you can love the sinner without participating in their sin. And number four, and I think most importantly, Christ says, "Man, you've got it all wrong. I'm not at this party because I'm a sinner. I'm at this party because I'm a doctor. It's they who are sick who need the physician." How long would you stay with a doctor who, when you called him up and said, "I've got to come in, I've got to see you," they said, "Well, as soon as you get the feeling better, you come on in. You stay away till then. But when your symptoms clear up, then I'll see you." Christ was with people at that party who had broken His heart. And He was there to redeem them. Because God desires mercy. Over and over and over, the prophets tell us, if there's anything God loves, it's mercy. Let me show you one passage. Jeremiah chapter 9. Look at verse 23 and 24. Listen to this. "Thus saith the Lord, let not the wise man glory in his wisdom, neither let the mighty man glory in his might. Let not the rich man glory in his riches, but let him that glorieth glory in this, that he understandeth and knoweth me, that I am the Lord, which exercise mercy, justice, and righteousness in the earth. For in these things I delight, saith the Lord." The God who said no more mercy just couldn't maintain that disposition. When He said it, He was speaking justice. When He said it, He was speaking truth. But thankfully, we serve a God of grace and truth. Full of grace and truth. Who loves mercy, who delights in mercy. I want to close by asking you to look at the very last chapter of Hosea, chapter 12, verses 3 and 4. Speaking about Jacob, "He took his brother by the heel in the womb, and by his strength he had power with God. Yea, he had power over the angel and prevailed. He wept and made supplication unto him. He found him in Bethel." You know the story. Jacob had cheated his brother. I'll talk about this the next study from Obadiah. He cheated his brother, ran from home, was gone for 20 years, and finally decides it's time to go home. Because God told him to. But he's nervous because he knows the last thing his brother Esau had said is, "I'm going to kill you." And his conscience was killing him. He knew he had done his brother wrong. And as he heads back to the Promised Land, the word comes that Esau is coming out with an armed force to meet him. So Jacob puts the children and women up front, hoping that would soften Esau up. And on the night before they met, Jacob has a dream. And sometime during the night, he finds himself wrestling with an stranger. And it wasn't a dream at all. It was actual. I don't know if he thought Esau had sent an assassin out. I don't know if he thought he'd been ambushed. Well, he spends all night wrestling with this stranger. And toward the breaking of day, when the stranger finally said, "Jacob, let's call a halt to this." The stranger touched his thigh, threw his thigh out of joint. And the stranger asked him, "Tell me your name." Remember that? Jacob said, "My name's Jacob." Now that's not like me saying my name's Tack. Or my name's Kenny. The word Jacob means cheater. And that's how Jacob had lived his life, cheating people, living by his wits, taking advantage of people. And what he did there in that passage in Genesis 32 was to finally own up to who he was. He finally confessed himself for the scoundrel that he was, and as soon as he did it, as soon as God saw a broken heart in Jacob, he was told, no, you're not Jacob any longer. Now you're Israel. And the word Israel means one who has